ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Friday, the 28th of November. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, one of the two National Guards shot in Washington, D.C. dies, and deep and melancholic, but the backbone of any orchestra, bassoonists stage a comeback.
At the Queensland Conservatorium, bassoon players are the superstars in the hallways. Whenever people see the bassoon players, they're always getting high fives and kudos and excitement.
Authorities have confirmed at least 94 people have died in Hong Kong's deadliest blaze in nearly 80 years. Firefighters have brought the inferno under control as rescue teams begin entering the seven high-rise towers to search for any survivors. The tragedy has put a spotlight on the use of flammable bamboo scaffolding and mesh for construction work, a tradition dating back centuries in China. Kathleen O'Connor has the story.
With the fire almost out, rescue teams have been able to enter the fire-ravaged public housing complex in Hong Kong's Tai Po district, searching for those still trapped inside the high-rise residential towers. Derek Armstrong Chan is the Deputy Director of Fire Services.
We will endeavour to effect forcible entry to all the units of the seven blocks concerned, so as to ensure that there are no other possible casualties.
It's Hong Kong's deadliest fire since 1948, when 176 people were killed in a warehouse blaze. Authorities say the fire that's been raging for more than 36 hours is now under control. At least 94 people have died, with hundreds still missing. Kelly Yu is a freelance journalist in Hong Kong.
We won't know the full number of missing people until the search and rescue operation wraps up. So that work is still very much underway. They've evacuated a woman, an elderly man, and even some pets. They're devastated watching their homes burn.
Lam Chek Ho is the Assistant Chief Ambulance Officer.
We have already handled 155 casualties. Among them, 79 casualties were confirmed fatalities as seen. We have sent all the rest of casualty to hospital. We have one fire personnel confirmed died.
Many locals still desperately trying to contact their loved ones and now faced with the harrowing task of checking to see if they are among the dead, as authorities set up a community hall with photos of the deceased. Kwan Hang Lok is a resident of one of the towers. He wasn't home at the time, but his 70-year-old mother is still missing. He's holding up a photo of her on his phone, asking if anyone has seen her.
She's missing. I looked for her all night. I looked for her all morning. I don't know where she is.
Meanwhile, the community rallies around those impacted, handing out donated clothes, blankets and food to those in evacuation shelters. 72-year-old Chan Un-Yin fled her home and needed some pyjamas.
I feel very touched by these things and I can wear this later. These will be useful for me tonight. I'm going to be staying at my friend's house temporarily.
Attention is now turning to what caused the inferno. Dangerous traditional materials used in the building's scaffolding is now under investigation. Arnold Tarling is a fire protection specialist in London.
Bamboo is a very cheap option. Mm. It's lightweight. It's actually, for the cross-section, stronger than steel. It flexes better than steel. And it's just put up with nylon ties and ropes. No need for special tools or anything. It's easily cut to length. And being lightweight, it's very easy to transport and erect. So, yeah, there's... Very much cheaper than scaffolding.
However, he says investigators are also looking at the mesh that was used on the outside of the building.
Once it starts burning, it goes up, it sets fire to the other materials around it, and you end up with air being sucked in at the bottom, the hot air going up the building, spreading out, creating chimney effects. You see that with a huge chimney of flame going up the side of the building. And all the fire load as well from the scaffolding has added to that, and plus the scaffold boarding. So they just built a huge bonfire.
Hong Kong police arrested three staff from a construction company on suspicion of manslaughter, saying the firm may have been grossly negligent in using unsafe materials.
Kathleen O'Connor. US President Donald Trump has paid tribute to the female member of the National Guard shot and killed in Washington, D.C. The male soldier, who was also shot, remains in a critical condition. The alleged shooter, a 29-year-old Afghan national, is in custody, and the shooting is being investigated by the FBI as an act of terrorism. America's editor John Lyons joined me a short time ago from Washington, D.C. John, what do we know about the dead member of the National Guard?
Well, Andy, we know that tragically the 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom from West Virginia has died. The president has announced that himself today, Thanksgiving here in America. So very sad news for the family. She was one of the two National Guards walking about three blocks from the White House yesterday, when a man came and it looked like it was a targeted attack. He certainly targeted them rather than civilians in the street, came up within close proximity, shot them. Both were taken to separate hospitals, and Sarah Beckstrom has now died. The other National Guard, a 24-year-old man, is still in hospital in a critical condition.
The Afghan national who's in custody, what do we know about him and the allegations against him?
Well, we know that he worked for the Americans in Afghanistan. Ramanullah Lakhanwal is his name, and he's the alleged shooter. He's reportedly, according to Associated Press and US officials who've spoken to them, allegedly worked for the CIA in Afghanistan, certainly worked for the Americans generally. And under the Biden administration, when the Americans had to withdraw from Afghanistan in those dramatic scenes we all saw, they tried to get as many of those Afghans who'd helped the Americans inside Afghanistan, giving them visas to come to the United States, almost as an acknowledgement of their work. And so this alleged shooter came in on one of those visas, and he's now certainly facing the full force of the law here. President Trump, a short time ago when he announced the death of Sarah Beckstrom, described the alleged shooter as a savage monster.
There is, of course, a controversial backdrop to this issue of the National Guard's deployment to Washington, D.C. And in fact, this incident has seen another 500 soldiers deployed, hasn't it?
That's right. Washington, D.C. is very much a Democrat town rather than a Republican city. It's always votes heavily Democrat. And there have been many protests here in recent months. Often when I'm walking home from work, I come across, there'll be protests in the northwest of Washington against the presence of the National Guard. And now they're very much a part of the fabric of Washington, D.C. You might be walking through DuPont Circle or some of the areas of Washington, D.C. and come across, they'll often be in groups of four or five, the National Guard, down 14th Street. So some of the main sort of restaurant and cafe areas, and President Trump deployed them here, he said, to try to make the city safer. But in response to this, the president has now ordered that another 500 of them come in to Washington, D.C. So the nation's capital, which is already deeply divided on this issue, on whether they should be deployed, will become more divided, because a lot of the people here in Washington say the police surely should be the people who are protecting the community from crime, not soldiers. And the National Guard are a part of the US military. So for some Americans, having soldiers on the streets of America is unwelcome. But for President Trump's support base, the MAGA support base, many of them think this is good, that this is showing a tough position on law and order.
America's editor John Lyons, I do appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Back home, and wild horses in the New South Wales High Country will no longer be protected under law after legislation to repeal the controversial Kosciuszko Wild Horse Heritage Act passed New South Wales Parliament last night. The act, introduced by former Deputy Premier and Nationals leader John Barilaro in 2018, legally protected Brumbies in recognition of their heritage value. Environmental groups have celebrated the news, hailing it a win for the native environment, while supporters of the horse are disappointed. Luke Radford.
There's no introduced species, potentially no animal, more divisive in Australia than the Brumbie. For those who love them, they're an important aspect of Alpine Australia's cultural heritage. But for others like CEO of the Invasive Species Council, Jack Goff, they're a blight on the landscape.
Feral horses trash, trample, degrade very sensitive alpine environments. There is no shortage of horses in Australia, but there is only a tiny slither of our country that is that precious alpine and subalpine environment.
Since 2018, feral horses in the Kosciuszko National Park in New South Wales have been legally protected under an Act of Parliament. The so-called Brumbie Bill, introduced by former Nationals leader John Barilaro, recognised the horse's value as part of Australia's heritage. Independent member for Wagga Wagga, Joe McGurr, whose electorate includes parts of the New South Wales Snowy Mountains, has been working to get the Brumbie Bill scrapped for several years.
The evidence was pretty clear. The feral horses were destroying significant parts of a very precious environmental heritage. We couldn't let that go on. You know, this hasn't been easy. We're not sort of kicking up our heels and rejoicing about this. This is really difficult stuff.
Just before midnight last night, Mr. McGurr's bill to repeal the Brumbies protection passed Parliament with support from Labor, Liberals, the Greens and Independents. He says it's long overdue.
Look, I understand how people feel on this issue very much. They're certainly wasted no time telling me what they feel about it, I have to say. But I think it's a small group of people. I think as the numbers in the Parliament have reflected, the vast majority of Australians get this. They understand how people feel about the horses and the Brumbies. Of course they do, but they also understand that there's a balance here and we need to get back to getting that balance right.
Brumbie advocates disagree.
They absolutely do have a value and deserve the recognition that they had. Unfortunately, they've decided to slaughter them based on false numbers, false science.
Nikki Alberts is president of the Australian Brumbie Alliance and believes a compromise was possible.
They basically walked away and rejected amendments that now mean that there will be no public consultations, no cruelty charges, no accountability if cruelty is proven, and no review of the new plan regardless of outcomes. So it's a lay-down misère to just go in and wholesale slaughter.
The fight around Brumbies has been an ugly one. National Park staff involved in the culling of feral horses have been repeatedly harassed, even being subjected to a firebombing threat in 2022. Wurundjeri man Richard Swain is the Indigenous ambassador for the Invasive Species Council. He says it's a significant moment.
It's a momentous day because it puts respect for country above colonial mythology, and that's rare in Australia, and I'm so grateful that that has happened and that it received bipartisan support, and, you know, it's been a fantastic effort by a lot of people over many years.
New South Wales Minister for Climate Change and the Environment, Penny Sharp, has called the scrapping of the bill a landmark decision that will protect the state's only alpine national park. For now, the existing management plan to retain 3,000 horses in the park will continue until at least mid-2027. But it's understood changes to feral horse management will begin after that.
That report by Luke Radford and Adrian Reardon. The search is continuing for a bull shark believed to be responsible for a fatal attack on the north coast of New South Wales. A young Swiss tourist is dead and another man is seriously injured. This marks the second shark attack death in New South Wales in 3 months, as an independent MP calls for greater drone surveillance of the beaches. Kimberly Price has the story.
Beaches along the mid-north coast of New South Wales have reopened this afternoon after a woman was killed in a shark attack yesterday. The attack happened at the secluded Kylie's Beach in the Crowdy Bay National Park, south of Port Macquarie. Dave Pearson surfs at the very same beach.
There's a bit of trepidation, I guess. Our usual Friday morning surf crew was me, That was it.
Another man suffered critical injuries, and the police confirmed the pair were Swiss tourists in their mid-20s. Dave Pearson says it's brought up difficult memories, but has found comfort in his shark attack support group called Bite Club, which he began after his own incident in 2011.
It lets you remember how lucky you were to survive, but also the ongoing trauma that's been since that day. And there's a lot of emotion in the air within our group on a day like today.
The Australian Shark Incident Database shows that more people have died from shark bites in the last 5 years than in the decade before. But Professor Cullen Brown from the Macquarie University School of Natural Science says the data doesn't mean sharks are becoming more common.
Sharks and rays are amongst the most threatened and endangered group of species in the world. The average number of fatalities is going up slightly. But if you look at the ratio of, you know, fatalities to the number of incidents, it's gone down a lot.
Initial investigations suggest the Kylie's Beach swimmers were attacked by a 3-metre bull shark. Professor Cullen Brown believes there may be a shift in sharks seeking colder seas down the south of Australia due to climate change.
What is definitely changing is the temperature of the waters. And there's no doubt that shark populations in general are shifting their distributions. And what's going to be interesting is how those shifts in distributions overlap with, you know, major urban areas like Sydney.
Michael Regan is an independent MP for Wakehurst on Sydney's northern beaches. He is pushing for more state-funded drone coverage for shark mitigation programs.
There's only 3 or 4 beaches on the northern beaches that during school holidays in summer that, and only weekends only, have actual drone coverage, whereas surfing is conducted on weekends from very early in the morning to pretty much all day. So we could increase coverage at a relatively cheap cost to government to give that extra protection.
Shark nets are a divisive topic due to their potential harm to marine life. But Michael Regan says it's a missed opportunity from the federal government not to address the issue in their new environmental protection laws.
People want to know factually whether they're effective or they're not effective. They want to know that there's a level of confidence, and there is a review around it.
Shark attack survivor Dave Pearson says his group will rally around the survivor of yesterday's incident and help plan a path forward.
We'll start reaching out to him today and get our phone numbers to him if he wants to contact us. And if possible, I'll take a drive down to Newcastle and go and say hi in hospital and try and fill him in on what the next few years of his life is probably going to be like.
Bite Club founder Dave Pearson. Ending that report by Kimberly Price. Treaty might be a recent victory for some Aboriginal groups on the mainland of Australia, but in the remote waters off Bass Strait, there's an island which is proud to manage itself. It's been 20 years since the Tasmanian government handed Trawana Cape Barren Island back to the Aboriginal community. Louise Mylan has the story.
It's 2005, and Denise Gardner sits in Hobart's Parliament House awaiting the fate of her island home.
Your heart's just thumping all the time. Decisions were
made. Politicians are debating a bill to hand Cape Barren and neighbouring Clark Island back to the Aboriginal community. With just one vote in it,
and I support the bill.
The bill passes. And later that year, the land is returned.
It was just the most fantastic day. One of the best days ever.
The moment had been decades in the making.
Tent embassies in Hobart, and the cops had come and ripped down the tents, and we'd go and find another tent somehow. We ended up having an umbrella at one stage. They even took that.
The islands in Bass Strait have seen some of the darkest parts of Australia's colonial history, from European sealers abducting Indigenous women to an open-air detention centre to the Stolen Generations. Annette Pearden was stolen from the islands as a child.
We did a runner, but of course they caught us. Took Mum off in one plane and took me and my brother off on a different plane.
She eventually met her mother again and returned to live on Trawana Cape Barren as an adult.
It's home. It'll always be home.
Annette Pearden is one of around 80 people living on the island today, most of whom are Indigenous. One shop, a post office and houses are nestled in a site called The Corner. The closest city, Launceston, is a plane ride away. It's known just as Town. Here's 9-year-old Natalia Maynard.
when you're in town, there's just so much cars and it's so loud, but here it's just so quiet.
The Cape Barron Island Aboriginal Association is central to the island's management. Aaron Maynard is the chair and Natalia's dad.
We own and manage everything on this island, all the infrastructure, aged care, shop, power, water.
The association receives state and federal funding and works with the council on neighbouring Flinders Island for some matters, like rubbish removal. But every decision goes through the association. It manages everything from roads to housing, with residents renting off the association for $50 to $100 a week. Aaron Maynard says Land Return gave the community agency to manage its own affairs.
We're not dictated by anybody but ourselves.
Kids can go to school here to year 12, though many still leave the island for more diverse opportunities. Two ranger groups care for the land, with programs from feral cat trapping to replanting kelp in the ocean. Buck Brown holds a senior role with the Truwana Rangers. He uses traditional burning to manage the bush.
Yeah, you can see where it's fingered through and trickled through. Hasn't burned everything. It only burned what it needed to burn.
After the land return in 2005, then Premier Paul Lennon said there would be more to come. But in the 20 years since, the Tasmanian government has not made any more significant land transfers to the Aboriginal community. Driving through the bush, Buck Brown says land return has made it easier to implement practices like burning, strengthening connection to his country.
Especially having a younger generation who grew up on this country and back home working on their own country. Yeah, no, it's a big thing. I suppose the lesson is keep on jumping up and down to the government and say we want our country back, our land back.
Truwana Ranger Buck Brown, ending that report by Louise Mylan. It's the deep, mournful sound to sadness, melancholy, or loss. And it looks like a strange bundle of barrels with a drinking straw poking out. The bassoon is a woodwind instrument that's the backbone for many orchestras. Thing is, it's fading out of fashion. Now, a shortage of players has led to a nationwide push for more young musicians to embrace the unique bassoon, as Molly Slattery reports.
The modest bassoon is an often overlooked member of the orchestra, but these long, tube-like instruments are actually a staple in a conductor's arsenal.
Bassoons are always the kind of humble heroes of the orchestra.
Associate Professor Tim Munro is the head of woodwinds at the Queensland Conservatorium in Brisbane.
Because actually, they serve an incredibly important role. They are like the bass note of a lot of things, but they also get to be the heart of the orchestra.
A Grammy Award-winning flute player himself, Mr. Munro has a deep respect for the moody bass of the bassoon.
If you're like watching a film and you're like, oh, why am I feeling a feeling right now? I think a lot of those times you'll notice that there's a bassoon playing in the orchestra. It has this like vulnerable human voice-like quality.
For the special few, like music student Ethan Henke, who know their way around the unusual instrument, it's a way of life.
My parents helped pay for my bassoon. It was about $8,000, this bassoon. They said, we'll match whatever you pay for your bassoon, or we'll match you buying a car. And I chose the bassoon.
But the woodwind has fallen out of fashion in recent years. Ethan Henke says fewer and fewer musicians are taking it up because it's a difficult instrument to play and teachers are few and far between.
My teacher mentioned how there's a worldwide shortage of bassoon players because most schools might have one bassoon player, that's it. You want three ideally.
Woodwind enthusiasts like Tim Munro are hoping more young people take up the endangered instrument. He says despite their obscurity to the general public, in the world of orchestra, bassoonists are a hot commodity.
At the Queensland Conservatorium, bassoon players are the superstars in the hallways. Whenever people see the bassoon players, they're always getting high fives and kudos and excitement.
The shortage of up-and-coming talent means skilled young players like Year 6 student Elena Ortez-Posada are using it to secure spots at prestigious high schools.
I auditioned for Brisbane State High through my bassoon a few months ago and I got in.
In the music rooms of primary schools across the country, these young protégés are honing their skills and hopefully Falling in Love with the Art of Orchestra. But as 11-year-old bassoon student Georgia Sullivan knows, becoming a brilliant bassoonist doesn't happen overnight.
I practice every day. It's really hard to play, but when you get the hang of it, it's really fun.
Yes, good on you, Georgia. Budding bassoonist Georgia Sullivan, ending that report by Molly Slattery. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. He's called a female journalist piggy and suggested Democratic politicians be arrested and possibly executed for seditious behaviour. Sounds like a pretty normal week for Donald Trump, but is it? Today's staff writer from The Atlantic magazine, Tom Nichols, on why the president's latest outbursts are a sign he's losing control of himself. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.